welcome back to another episode of Glow West, where we talk about sex, sexuality, and the body. I'm your host, Dr. Caroline West, and I'm here to help shine a soft light on sex-related issues. Glow West is delighted to be part of the Tortoise Shack Network, where you can find lots of great podcasts on politics, culture, and of course, sex. Today we're talking about the wonders of the vagina, the womb, and all the bits in between. My guest is an expert on this area, and her new book called The Vagina Book is out tomorrow. Dr. Jen Conti is a medical journalist and OBGYN physician. She received her MD from the University of California in San Francisco, and she also holds master's degrees in journalism from Columbia University and epidemiology from Stanford University. She's passionate about reproductive health advocacy clinically and when it comes to national policy, and she's based in California's Bay Area. Hi, Jen. How are you? Thank you so much for joining me today.
Good. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for being here. Tell me how you got into this work. It's a very specialized area, of course.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you a little bit about how I got into OBGYN, how I got into media work, and all of the above and how it goes together. But I actually came from a very conservative background. My family was very anti-choice, did not believe in reproductive rights, did not believe in gay marriage, basically was very, very conservative. And so I grew up with that mindset, thinking that that was truth. And it wasn't really until college where I started to meet people who had had different life experiences, people who had had abortions, people who were gay, probably knowing in real life I had, you know, known people all along who had had these experiences, but just, you know, didn't feel safe telling me. And, you know, I think as a lot of people, you start to sort of blossom and develop your own thoughts about the world and how the world works. And just through that experience was realized that I had just, you know, been very close-minded, and really these beliefs that I had been taught my whole life weren't really how I felt. And then in the years that followed, medical school, residency, and then, as you mentioned, this time getting a degree in journalism, I really started to take that passion specifically for women's health and try to give power to this message that, you know, that everyone should really approach these issues with an open-minded lens, even if your own life experiences don't provide that opportunity. So specifically with media, you know, I've really tried to use this as a platform for public health and tried to really destigmatize, demystify all aspects of women's health.
And that's fascinating to me about media, because coming from Ireland, we haven't been the best at being maybe open-minded in the media or informed sometimes, or, you know, we're sticking to sensationalist topics as well. And of course, we just had a referendum on abortion access 2 years ago now. So that was just, right. It was just a war zone in the media. And it was just pretty horrific and quite traumatizing to a lot of people who had been in that experience, and just either the lies or the mistruths or just the mischaracterization of people that were there. So how do journalists and the media report ethically on these issues without being sensationalist about it?
You know, it's hard. And I think this is one of the things that I realized when I was trying to decide, do I want to go into media in general, whether that means writing or talking on the news, radio, podcasts. But it, like halfway through my medical school time, when you start to meet patients in the clinic, I realized that people were really giving a lot more weight and listening to messages they were receiving about their bodies from the media more than they were their own physicians. And looking into it further, I realized that what are the qualifications to report on anything women's health related? There really are none.
Scarily low.
Scarily low. And so to compare and contrast that, to report the weather, for example, you have to have, at least in the U.S., a meteorology degree. You have to go through this very extensive training to just tell someone what the weather is going to be like that day. But to tell them about their body or any kind of truths about reproductive health, nothing. And so, like you said, you end up getting a lot of sensationalized, overblown, or just false messaging about health in general, but specifically women's health.
And it leads to things like, you know, every summer there's always an article about women, you're advised to not put ice lollies into your vagina to cool down.
It's like, I'm sorry, what's an ice lolly?
Like like an ice pop, frozen liquid stuff.
This
comes up every summer, and I think it's like the actual same article, just they changed the date on it, or like, but just stupid things like that where it's like no one's actually that. Like, no one that owns a vulva or vagina has thought, I know how to cool down. I'm going to put a sugary ice pop into my vulva instead of like getting air conditioning or something. Like, so it's like, it's just nonsense, you know?
It's nonsense. And I think we know that, right? And I say it in media very broadly, but I think people, producers, editors, writers, people know deep down that they're, just societally, we have a lot of insecurities about our bodies as women. We've been taught for generations to be ashamed, to buy into this stigma that your vulva, your vagina, your period, everything is bad or dirty. And then, of course, you want to create some content that sells or that gets clicks. And so you know that the way to do that is to sort of, whether you're doing it inadvertently or inadvertently, capitalize on these insecurities. And it's cheap. It needs to stop. And I think the way to do it is to overpopulate with good information.
That's why I love social media now, and you know how so many people are using it as education, until of course Instagram shuts down platforms and stuff. But it's right. So like, I've learned so much from Instagram that I haven't had in, you know, my sex education in school, or, you know, mm-hmm. in general periods. Like, if we're looking at like period stuff, I didn't know the names of the different phases about menstruation until I learned that from social media, and that was like,
yeah,
only like 5 years ago or something, which is shocking. You know, that's like in my mid-30s, after experiencing periods for the majority of my life, I couldn't even name those different phases. And it just makes me really sad, because obviously I'm not the only one in that situation. And oh, it's just, yeah, it's really frustrating. So like, what are your thoughts on how period education, well, it might be different in the US. I'm sure it's probably lacking from where you would like it to be.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not surprised to hear that.
I don't know. I don't know the state in other countries, but I know that it's, I would say, overall egregious in the U.S. Now, you do have some exceptions where some states or school districts maybe potentially have some good, solid sex education, but the problem in the U.S. is that it's decentralized. There are some guidelines federally that our government suggests, but there's no unifying force that that enforces these suggestions. And so depending on the state you're living in, and there are some pretty conservative states in this country, you could essentially, all you could learn is that abstinence is best, and that's it. Like, don't even talk about sex, because if we talk about it, it will lead to STDs and pregnancy and, you know, yada, yada, yada. But so anyway, like you were saying about social media and this book, is that you sort of bypass that. You bypass what the government is not doing, what our leaders are not doing, which is providing high quality, accessible information about your body. And you find that through reputable sources online, Instagram, or a book like this, where you can access it in a very approachable way, and in a way that's easy to read and talk about with your friends.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting when it goes through all the different phases of the menstrual cycle, and just how accessible it was, because sometimes it feels like you need a science degree to read some of the articles about sexual health.
Yeah.
And you know, not everyone has that, most people don't, but I love that it's accessible, and like even the images and the graphics, it just all feels very calm and very soft and gentle and accessible. And it's actually, I was just refreshed reading it. It's just nice to read something that isn't scaremongering, and something that's just like calm and also like cute and pretty as well.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of books out there on understanding women's health, and certainly like there's a lot of really great approaches, but the thing I love so much about this is that it is so accessible and so, not intimidating. And it's everything from the illustrations, the illustrators just fantastic, to the language, to, you know, the way it splits it up in chapters and very easy to read, digestible pieces. And Thinks for the long time has been just fantastic about this. This is a company that has for the longest time focused on destigmatizing period health, and bringing new ways to how we think about manage our periods and more broadly women's health. So you can see that theme throughout the book. It's just, I love it so much.
Well, and that's an important point you're saying there about, so Thinx are the company that make period pants, and they're a new enough product, you know, if you look at the history of, I suppose, how we dealt with periods. And but I think there's a date in the book that the pads were the first new invention for a long time in the area of like period products. It was like tampons and pads, and that was it for like the longest time. And now obviously we have a lot more options, which is great, but that's pretty nice to see, I suppose, that like combating of stigma alongside with like, here's some actual different options for those who can't use periods or pads or for whatever reason. So that bit's
nice. Yeah. And I mean, I think just as a physician too, I see people in clinic every day, you know, who still don't know that alternatives to pads and tampons exist, which is, you know, I'm not surprised, just because, again, lacking centralized education. But certainly there are innumerable people that, you know, tampons and pads aren't the best option for them. And then you introduce them to something like the menstrual cup or to period underwear, you know, where you can, some people say free bleed, you know, and it's revolutionizing for them. It's better for their skin. It's, you know, it's better for their lifestyle. And I love that part of the job, you know, just really helping to spread that education.
That's awesome. Well, I wrote an article on eco-friendly period products back, I think it was February or something like that. And a woman who sold them in Ireland said her clients say that their teenage girls use them for sport, which is really interesting because previously they had dropped out because they didn't want to worry about a pad falling out if you're in the middle of a football pitch or something. And that's huge because a lot of young girls do drop out of sport and or feel really uncomfortable going to, you know, PE classes and exercising. And, you know, you also don't want to feel uncomfortable or worrying about a tampon leaking, that kind of thing. So it's actually nice to, like, that's gender equality as well, you know, if you can encourage girls to stay in education. So, yeah,
absolutely. And I think you mentioned the gender equality thing. I think something we don't think about too, but especially given that we are trying to, you know, be more mindful of transgender rights, is that, say, for example, you have a trans masculine person who, you know, is masculine for all intents and purposes, but may still have a uterus and bleed, and just using a tampon or a pad can be really triggering. So in that way, these alternative options are really, you know, they do just that. They really help with gender equality, LGBT equality, you know.
And not be like branded with like the Venus symbol or like, you know, traditionally feminine issues, because that can cause a lot of dysphoria as well in trans people. So it's actually nice just to have plain black or even for like anybody, like just a pair of like plain black underwear is just nice. You just, sometimes you don't need, you know, like feminine messages of like, you go girl, you're because it's just a period. It's
right.
That's fine.
But, I just need black underwear in case I leak.
Yeah. One of the soul, I think, products, like my sex education now in school is, you're like, we're going back to like the 90s now. So we're really going back far. But it was my teacher telling me about how she had to wear a sanitary pad attached with a belt, and which sounded like a horrendous contraption. Like, Is the belt over clothes? Is it under your clothes? Like, it just, that just seems horrific to try and wear something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I would hear these stories from my mother also. And, you know, we're talking about things that I guess if you can try to imagine, like a jock strap essentially, but like underneath your clothes, but then you would snap in or attach the pad to that belt and then wear it under your clothes. Yeah, and then even generations before that, I mean, the whole saying, I'm on the rag, you know, coming from literally sitting on a physical rag and then just sitting on it, because if you get up, it's going to go everywhere and off the rack.
And like the potential for infection and everything like that. And then just,
oh yeah.
And like, you want to get on with your day. You don't want to sit down on a rag all day, you know.
You don't want to sit on a rag for
five days. one thing in the book I thought was interesting was the aspect of racism in it as well. So if we're talking about the belt. So this was a quote from the book. If you're wondering how people kept their pads in place before adhesive, meet the sanitary belt, which held pads in place with a belt. So Mary Beatrice Davison Kenner, she's a badass you've never heard of, which I appreciate that, patented the belt, but her initial investors backed out when they found out that she was a black woman. So, I mean, like, the history of racism just really penetrates everything, doesn't it? It's just...
Oh, it does. Well, I mean, especially with women's health, we have just like such a horrible history of racism in our field of medicine specifically. And if you look into just like the invention of the speculum, for example, it was tested on black women who at the time, you know, physicians argued that black women didn't feel pain or they didn't feel it in the same way because they were less human than white people. And then it escalates all the way to modern day when we're looking at, you know, higher maternal mortality rates among black women and how there is no biological reason for that. It is, you know, systemic and structural racism that continues to make that an issue. And so I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised that that's the story because that's been our history.
Yeah.
But like you say, oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, like, that happens in Ireland as well. Like, you know, a great proportion of our maternal deaths are made up of either migrants or, you know, non-white identified people. And it's just, like, it's shocking. And the same complaints over black people don't feel pain the same way, which is obviously ridiculous. Mm-hmm. It's just, yeah, infuriating.
I think we were taking all of that into account when we were putting this book together, trying to... not only make it accessible, like you were saying, but trying to really speak to the truths that have come before or historically where we are today, and also making sure to include voices of all kinds of people. So you'll see voices from really prominent people in different communities, Roxane Gay, Ingrid Nielsen, Margaret Cho contributes. There's a lot of different voices throughout, just trying to really drive home the fact that when we talk about period health and women's health, it's not just one size fits all story. Like the lived experiences for people are so different depending on your cultural background, your socioeconomic background, your racial background. And it can't just be one voice.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, because it's not a period isn't experienced universally all over. So yeah, we need to have that diversity, which I love. So if we're on the subject of myths, one of the biggest myths that infuriates me, this is a very infuriating conversation for me for a lot of reasons. It's so annoying. The idea that virginity is some sort of either prize or something that we can judge women by. And you mentioned this in the book as well about the hymen and how, you know, the symbolism of that. So I'll let you talk on that because I feel like rant coming on and I'll just start screaming because this is just one of my bugbears over how women are treated so poorly about the state of this tiny, tiny flap of skin. And we have countries that do like virginity tests on women or people with vaginas. So it's just infuriating. Yeah, I'll let you rant because I'll rant too much on this one.
No, I feel like we're probably going to rant about the same things, which is this is the overarching message. Virginity is a social construct. This idea that virginity is a thing, like a medical entity, is just bullshit. I don't know if I'm allowed to cuss on your
head. Go for it.
Yeah, but it's nonsense. And we talk about it. I think the biggest evidence of that is that we talk about this entity differently for traditionally feminine people and traditionally masculine people, right? Like for women or feminine people, virginity is this prize to be won. And it isn't ever talked about in the same way for young boys or men. And then, you know, this idea that it has something to do with this flap of skin, like you're saying, I mean, it is literally, that flap of skin is literally the division between your upper and lower vagina. And it has everything to do with just how the body evolved and how the vaginal parts came together. It has nothing to do with, you know, the first sex or, you know, how pure you are. And so you get all of these nonsense social construct terms attached to it, and it starts to, at a very young age, build this idea that one, sex is different for girls than boys, and two, women should be a certain person, right? Women should be pure, they should be honorable, they should be unspoiled, right? And you hear this this analogy to food a lot too, right? Like popping the cherry, and there's just all these like really creepy things that come into play. right? So it just, yeah, rant on. Please join me in the rant.
Well, and the education around this as well, like me growing up, I thought this was like this huge big thing inside of me, you know, and it, like, it was something that you could really, really feel. It's like the size of a coin or something like this. And then, then I had this irrational fear of like, I'd break my hymen going horse riding. Now, I think I've ridden a horse about twice in my life, and they were like when I was an adult. But like, it was all this conversation of like, you can break it riding a bike and, you know, putting a tampon in. And then like, I was like constantly afraid for some reason of like, oh, have I destroyed my hymen? Like, what's going on? And it was like, I don't know if it's there or not, or all those things. And it's just nonsense. Like, it can
and
be,
like, who cares? Who cares if it's there or not?
Like, it's
I don't
nothing
know why
about
it's
me.
Always associated with a horse, right? But I think, like, it's interesting to hear you say that, because even in the US, like, it's always associated with a horse.
Yeah, how many people go horse riding?
I don't know. Funny you say that. I remember, as a kid, I remember once, I think I must have been, like, 12 or 13, I was sweeping for my mom. I was helping her do chores. And the top of the broom, I think I was like dancing with it, and I accidentally jabbed myself in the vulva somehow. I don't know. But I remember I fell to the ground in pain and was like, oh my God. Oh my God, my hymen. Like, that was the second thought, you know? But like, why is a 12-year-old thinking that?
Oh my gosh. Like, and then the anxiety over like, oh, I'm not going to be marriageable now, or, you know, people are going to think I'm dirty, or all these horrendous thoughts. And, what I didn't know till recently as well were like, there's so many different types of hymen. So you list in the book, like there's three main common types, but I think I've seen a graphic somewhere that said there's something like 8 different varieties of them. I'm not sure if that's correct or not.
It's not necessarily that it's a different type. I mean, so a hymen is a hymen, but when the anatomy is coming together in the fetus, in the female fetus, most often, like, the central part of the hymen will go away, and so you'll just have this ring or this remnant, but it doesn't happen that way for everyone. So sometimes it doesn't completely dissolve, and it's imperforate, meaning it's a complete blockage, and so that would be something that, like, surgically we would have to fix before they were able to insert tampons or have periods or sex penetratively. Or sometimes there's little tiny holes, it's little micro perforations. And there's all these different names for basically different variations in how much of the hymenal tissue is left by the time someone realizes it.
Okay.
But it means nothing, you know?
No, but what I saw, I actually only saw this about 2 weeks ago, you can buy what's known as, and air bunny quotes, a Chinese hymen. So this is like a fake hymen.
Sorry, what?
I assume it's called Chinese because it's coming from China, and not reference to the people. But so you can buy it before, I assume, sex for the first time, and put it inside yourself. And it's like, I think it's like just a squishy pouch of maybe of blood or something. Mm-hmm. And I thought I saw one for sale on Facebook, which is really concerning. So for like public service announcement, do not put anything into your vagina that you buy on Facebook Marketplace.
Oh my
That's
God.
Not a good
or,
idea.
Or a fake hymen. Oh my God. I feel like we need to tag that. We need to find that and...
I'm going to put up an Instagram post about that. So.
Oh my God.
But you can also have like hymen reconstruction surgery as well. Is that correct?
There is, yes, there's basically, if you can imagine it, I'm sure you could find someone in the world to do it. And I think the centralizing theme, again, is that it comes back to this idea that a lot of different societies and cultures put so much unnecessary value and historical value on this hymen. I mean, you see a lot of different cultures all over the world have like the marital bed sheets where you'll put down a sheet. And, you know, if on the first night after the person has wed, if there's not blood on the sheet, then they're not a virgin, which is nonsense because... For many people, blood doesn't happen even with their first penetrative intercourse.
It's also creepy to have your relatives hanging outside your door wanting to inspect your dirty, like, bloody sheets.
So creepy. I'm a huge, like, British royalty history buff. I love it. And I'm imagining, you know, like, King Henry era where, like, it wasn't even hanging outside the room. They were literally outside the canopy watching and listening.
Jeez. Okay, thank you. We've moved on a little bit from a lot of that. So, but on the topic of myths, the book also mentions different types of period myths. And I like this because when you have the absence of education, myths take that place and they come in.
Right.
And one of my favorite myths in it is that animals are not attracted to your period blood. Because again, growing up, I had this image, and I think it was from reading the book Jaws, which I probably shouldn't have been reading at such a young age. And I thought the woman in it got her period when she swam and the shark was attracted to the blood, and that's how she got eaten by the shark. Now, we don't have sharks in Ireland, but this was a very real fear of mine for a long time of like a shark was going to eat me if I went swimming with my period, which is ridiculous. But yeah, what are those other myths that, that you hear most often about periods? Because there's a lot, I think.
So many myths. I think, I mean, animals, that's a huge one. And again, it's always shocking to me how like these myths get perpetrated, you know, trans culturally and trans continentally. We've all heard the same myths. Another really common one, and I think this is like a more concerning or dangerous one, is that you can't get pregnant if you're on your period.
Yes.
Which isn't true necessarily. And the reason I put like sort of an asterisk with that is because it's very hard, I think, for a lot of people to separate period as a cultural phenomenon from period as a medical entity, because there's so much culturally attached to someone's period and to their bleed, as we've just been talking about. But when you think about it from a purely medical standpoint, and a period as something that happens 2 weeks after you ovulate, then yes, theoretically, if you're having normal periods, and this is just the withdrawal bleed after you ovulate, then you shouldn't be fertile at that time. But the reality is a lot of people bleed irregularly, or they bleed at times that are not just associated with, you know, the ovulation bleed. And if you in your head think, oh, that's a period, because culturally any bleed is a period, then you may think it's safe to have sex then. And you know, if you aren't having normal periods, if you aren't tracking it, it's not as reliable.
That I was grateful for, because I got a lot of my sex education from Cosmopolitan magazine and the SEAL section, because I'm not in school.
Oh yeah, me too.
Yeah, it was like, it was good for some things, not for others. But I remember in fifth year in school, so we would have been 16-ish, kind of 15, 16. And there were already a few pregnant people in the class anyway, and a few that had already had a baby. Mm-hmm. And we had these people come in, and I can't remember where they're from, but they were teaching us about the rhythm method, and that's how, you know, or the Billings method of, you know, if you check your mucus, and I hear the word mucus, I don't know how many times it's scarred into my brain. This is like a therapy session here today, unloading all my childhood trauma around periods. But they kept mentioning mucus over and over again, and I was like, just going, oh my God, just please just stop. But they said, you absolutely cannot get pregnant on your period. And I was like, aha, I know this to be false. And they argued back and they said, no, you cannot get pregnant on your period. And I was like, there's a lot of pregnant people in this room right now, and this is just dangerous to spread this around. And they had none of it. They were like, no, that's it. It's just shocking to see that.
It's hard too, because there's a lot of other ulterior motives often with sexual education too. Like Ireland is a traditionally Catholic country, and the Catholic community here in the US also is very, very adamant about promoting abstinence only. And if you're doing abstinence only, then really the only thing that you would agree to teach or to partake in is this idea of the rhythm method. For even Catholic people who are married, right? Like a lot of times they're encouraged not to use birth control. And if you've got clockwork periods, if they're like, you know, on time and you can trust them, then, and you're great about noticing the consistency of your mucus. Sorry to say that triggering word.
Traumatized.
Then maybe, you know, maybe it'll work for you, but to apply it broadly to everyone and all comers, all period comers, I guess, is dangerous, because it's not that reliable for the masses, I guess. And there's a lot of other things out there that are way more reliable.
And that's the idea of like that one size fits all, and it just, that's not how bodies work. And it's definitely not even how each gender works, and
not how people work.
No.
Yeah.
You also talk about one of my favorite topics in the book as well, which are orgasms, because yay. Yay for like fun sex topics. You also talk about the G-spot. Obviously, you know, there's different aspects to you know, female genitalia. There's still currently the debate happening on whether or not the G-spot exists. Now, I think it was a couple of months ago Cosmopolitan came out and said no, it doesn't exist anymore. Case closed, you know, that's it. So where are we on that? Does it exist, or is it part of the clitoral structure, or where are we going with that?
Yeah, well, I think shockingly, I guess, in sort of overarching this whole question, is that we didn't quite understand clitoral anatomy until relatively recently either. You know, people for the longest time thought it was just that part that you could see without realizing that the gland extends, you know, much further along the vulva than we actually thought. And so, you know, for the longest time, people are trying to figure out, well, where is it that women orgasm from? Is it one spot? Is it multiple spots? Where is it located? And then you have this idea that maybe it's deep in the vagina in this one particular spot. If you ask the medical community, by and large, most people are going to say, no, it's not a real thing necessarily. But I think the thing to really pay attention to is that female sexuality in general is a lot more complex than we have given it credit for. Is it possible that there are parts of female sexuality that we do not understand? 100% yes. Because that's just an area that's starting to be explored right now. And, you know, even like if you go back and look at what we know about orgasms in general in terms of like the data that we have, it's by and large based on data and studies that mostly focused on men. Which is very, very different. And so I, you know, do I personally believe it exists? Yeah, no, not really. But I do think that there are structures in and around the whole, you know, vulva, clitoris that all contribute to a very complex orgasm for women traditionally.
The science in the area is so new. Like the full structure of the clitoris wasn't discovered till like 20 years ago or something. It's just missing lot of textbooks since then or before then. I blame Freud for a lot of this. I studied psychoanalysis, and Freud's idea of a mature woman was a woman who only had a vaginal orgasm, and a woman who had a clitoral orgasm was an immature woman, and she needs to just cop on and stop having an orgasm that way. And then female psychoanalysis spent 10 years going, no, you are wrong about this. And he just refused to listen to him, and then everyone just seemed to forget about the clitoris after that for like almost 100 years, which is ridiculous.
I know, which is ridiculous, because we know now that that's like a huge part of orgasm.
There's patriarchy, there's misogyny, there's ignorance, there's a whole lot of different issues wrapped up in that, I think.
So much. And I haven't said it yet, but I mean, like, for the work that you do in your specific area, like, thank you. This is so great. We need more and more researchers and people who are focused on this.
This is why, like, this is why the podcast exists, because I'm like, we need to have more conversations about pleasure and science and so much. There's so much. We will be talking about a lot of content on the podcast for a while, because there's a lot there.
You will run out.
One of the topics that I suppose I've been looking at a little bit lately, especially on social media for various reasons, in Ireland, there was some conversations that came up about the idea of revenge porn. Now, I don't use that word. I use image-based sexual abuse. I think in the book you call it something else. NCP, was it? Or non-consensual pornography, I think.
I forget the exact acronym, but yeah, exactly.
So I think like this is a conversation that we absolutely need to have, and we need to have a ASAP. So I was really glad to see that included in the book as well, because I think this is lacking in a lot of education. Like, we focus on consent, but a lot of the time we're talking about in-person sexual encounters, and we're not talking about image-based either encounters or being used for abuse as well. So where do you see that going? You know, how do we talk to people who are victims of this? How do we talk to people who are perpetrators of this? Like, I view them as committing a form of sexual violence, and the people who share those images, even if they're not in or didn't take it, are also committing sexual violence. And I think that's a nuance that we need to stick to. It's not just something fun to share. It's an act of violence towards somebody.
It is. And I think it's a space that we're starting to try to explore more, just with you know, social media, well, the internet just being, you know, relatively not that old, and social media specifically not, you know, being that old. I often think about, so I've got two young daughters, and I often think, oh my God, like, they're going to be in junior high soon and high school soon. These are things I need to start talking to them about, warning them about. How do I talk to them about this? And then thinking back to what it was like to be in junior high, high school for myself, and this didn't exist. And oh my God, it's this whole new space that we have to navigate that's very challenging. I think there's a lot of different conversations, and different conversations for different types of people. So the way we talk to people who might traditionally be the victims of this kind of material, which theoretically could be anyone, you know, and the people who might traditionally be more inclined to, or more empowered to use this type of material, it needs to be different, but consistent. The messaging needs to be consistent that this is a type of violence, that, you know, the idea of consent, which we are thankfully talking more and more about to young people, needs to expand not just to like physical touch, but like, do you have your consent to take a picture of someone, even if in the moment you are in a loving relationship or a trusting situation with them? Does the consent extend to just taking the photo, or, you know, the whole follow-up with what you intend to do with that photo, what happens to the photo afterwards, that sort of thing? I think it needs to be a conversation that we have more publicly, but because, of course, it's a sensitive topic, it involves sex and, you know, especially in some situations, younger people, it's something that the people in power and who have the ability to help make laws and, you know, protections are going to shy away from. And that's a shame.
I think we need to have a huge conversation about the blame aspect of it, you know, and the fact that, you know, the statement you'll see so much on social media, and you see it in connection to other forms of sexual assault as well, is, and it's usually gendered, it's, if she had kept her legs closed, it wouldn't have happened.
Right.
And obviously right. That negates other genders being victims as well. But it's the idea of, like, it's still that myth of sexual assault only happens either from strangers or, you know, in some different mm-hmm. situation. Like, it's in relationships, it's in the family, it's your close friends, it's not necessarily, I think, like, stranger sexual assault is like less than 10% or something of overall sexual assault. It's more mm-hmm. relationships and stuff. So how do we challenge that narrative, especially in the media as well? Because I do see a lot of media outlets giving in to that blame of the victim.
That's hard. I think it's hard because probably the solution is coming at it from like a multi, you know, pronged approach, where like you have bigger organizations like Instagram, Twitter, Facebook actually making restrictions or trying to catch it as, you know, potentially violent crime, like treating it like a violent crime and flagging it and taking this stuff down. But I think that unless we are starting, again, like looping this in with part of sexual education and the way we talk about sex in general with young people, if we don't do that, the messaging, again, comes from what they see on social media, and that is not up to par right now. So it has to come from multiple angles. It's the only way I think that it would, you know, be effective.
Yeah. And because it is, it's like, you know, you're dealing with methods of communication, you're dealing with gender, you're dealing with sex, you're dealing with sexual assault. There's so much to it. So, and then of course, if people are underage as well, then that's like filmed child sexual abuse. And I know in the States, so there have been people prosecuted, you know. And but I saw one case in the States before. I think I was listening, not sure whose podcast it was, but there was someone who, it was a girl who was the victim of it, and the guy shared around her nudes, and she got expelled from the school, and he didn't. Mm. And it just made me want to burn everything and just the rage. But is that the case, you think? Are you seeing cases of people being treated equally in that matter? Or I know there's a long way to go in it.
You know, I'm not seeing it personally. I know it exists. But I think the patriarchy is very deep, you know. And even if it's... there's this idea of like unintentional patriarchy too, or, you know, the person at school, for example, this kid who gets expelled, like, are the people who are there and supporting her, do they even know that they're contributing to this society, or are they just doing what they think is right? And,
It's infuriating.
It's not something that I think people feel. It's interesting, actually, relating it to women's health. I often talk about like the things people come to the office and feel comfortable talking about and the things they don't bring to the office. As a gynecologist, people, I am honored because people bring, you know, very private, sensitive topics that they don't often feel comfortable talking about with their friends, their family members, their, you know, the people they're closest with in their life. And this is an example of one of those things where I wish more people would talk to their gynecologist about, because so much of women's health extends to a public health and safety aspect, especially around sexual safety and wellness. And I think the truth of the matter is because it's so stigmatized, a lot of people hold this in still.
Yeah, for sure. And I suppose to change the conversation to a slightly lighter note, things like, I suppose what some of us might think of as basic, but you know, it's not basic if you're in this situation, but things such as like, how long do you leave a period in for, or how long do you leave a tampon in for, or how long do you wear period pants for, or, you know, a pad, like things like that. Do you get people coming to see you with questions like that and being embarrassed by that? Because like for someone who's, you know, very experienced in it, you might think, oh, how does everyone not know this? But when you're really young or you haven't had education, you know, you might know about that. And, you know, it's taken that, I suppose, compassionate approach of thinking, you know, people don't know everything.
By and large, one of the first things I do when I realize that someone's coming to see me a gynecologist for the first time is make sure before we get into any kind of physical exam, one, I let them know, and I say these exact words: you are in control here. If there's anything you need me to do, if you need me to stop, if you need me to just, you know, if we need to talk through something, just tell me, but you are in control. And then the other thing is, before we actually start doing the exam, I give them a mirror and I tell them to use the mirror and look down, and I give them like a tutorial, like an anatomy lesson. And I'm literally like, this is your vulva, just, you know, pointing to the whole thing. Here are your labia majora. Here are your labia minora. This is your clitoris. And I'll literally show them their clitoris and kind of make a joke.
I'm thank like, you for
I'm
doing
like,
this.
Here's your clitoris. Tell all the guys, you know, because they don't know. Yeah. Here's your vagina. Here's your urethra where the, you know, the pee comes out, and here's your anus. And I literally go through all of this with them because I know that a lot of people, I mean, when people think about their own genitalia, one, if they're even brave enough to look, right? Because a lot of people don't look and they don't know. I had a girlfriend, I kid you not, who it was in college when she realized she had three holes down there. She thought she only had two. She was 19.
I think that's scarily common.
It is scarily common. And so I walk them through all of this because the biggest thing that people think when they do, when they are brave enough to look down there is this normal? Does this look okay? Is this okay? You know, and is the odor okay? Is the hair okay? Is the smell okay? There's so many questions, but it's all this idea of, am I normal? So if you just start the conversation with like, here is everything, it is normal, you know?
I think that would be such a lovely way to start like a smear test, because I don't know many women people with vaginas who actually enjoy a smear test. Like, it's usually something that a lot of people will put off for a long time. And in Ireland we have a history of smear tests not even being analyzed properly and people with cervical cancer being left for years and years and dying as a result. So that's a fairly headline thing at the moment here. But how can you make a smear test more comfortable? So say you're a person going in for one and you don't have an awesome OBGYN like yourself, you've got someone who literally, you know, is going to shove a speculum in you kind of thing. So how do you take control of that and say, okay, here's what I'd like to have, let's try and make this a more pleasant experience for someone who isn't going to be as cool as you?
It's hard, right? Because there's this power dynamic. There's a power dynamic of like doctor, not doctor, person in a white coat, if they're wearing a white coat. This is another thing. I never wear a white coat. I mean, if I don't have to, because I think it introduces a power dynamic in a very intimate setting. And you know, there's a whole other thing too. Like sometimes there's a generational gap. You've got an 18-year-old girl coming in for her first exam, and maybe your OBGYN is like a man in his 60s. You know, like there's a lot to cross there. But if a person feels empowered enough to do so, and I would always encourage someone to do this, to feel empowered, and the person, if your gynecologist isn't starting this, I would say, you know, stop, or like just kind of put a hand up as you're about to start and say, this is my first time with this exam. Would you mind, before you do anything, just showing me everything down there and showing me and talking me through this and telling me if it's normal, you know? And I think that any doctor, even one of a more traditional one who's never, you know, been faced with a very empowered patient before, what do you say to that? You know, you can't say anything but, oh yes, of course, let me show you, you know, otherwise you'd be a dick.
hopefully not, but yeah. Or even yeah. things like ask them to warm up the speculum or warm up their hands.
Yeah,
that's always a nice
warm up touch. Your hands. Different sizes of speculums, right? Speculums come in different sizes and shapes. It's definitely, again, not a one size fits all. Using lots of lubricant so it doesn't pinch. You know, like we often talk about this idea of verbicane, which is, you know, like kind of like lidocaine, like a numbing medicine, but verbally, like if you're just talking to someone and kind of, you know, making them feel relaxed, disarming them, it can really go so far.
Yeah. It's not a normal, you know, situation for most people to be in. We're not normally there with someone poking us with something. So, I've had one smear test where it literally felt like she was looking for socks in a wash machine. It just felt like it was like round and around and around. But thankfully, that was a rare thing. You know, they've mostly been okay. But I feel sorry for people who only have that experience and then dread going and stuff. One thing I think is really important to cover is people who've been victims of sexual assault might find smear tests really uncomfortable and then end up putting them off, which is totally understandable. Mm-hmm. But then obviously there's risks of, you know, cervical cancer and stuff. How can people with that experience make that a more comfortable situation?
It's hard because, again, a lot of times if that's your truth, some people are very open about it and have gotten to a place where they feel empowered to, you know, just close that up front and say, hey, look, I've had this history. Please be very gentle, be very slow, which they should be anyway. But a lot of times people hold that in. And there's research showing actually that you have to ask someone, literally, I think it's like 7 or 9 times, if they are safe, like say someone is being abused in the moment, before they'll finally say yes or they'll finally admit to it a lot of times. So even when we ask people and screen them, they may say no. But this is why I lead with this question of like, you are in control here. No matter what happens, you're in control. You can tell me to stop. If your provider doesn't say that, you know, I would just say, and you're not comfortable disclosing any kind of history like sexual assault, then you can just say, again, this exam is really hard for me, you know, or I'm really nervous right now. If I ask you to stop, can you please just stop, you know? Can you please listen?
I think that's really important. I know, like, obviously it's not the same, but when I go to the dentist, I have such fear. I hate the dentist so much. So,
I hate the dentist.
I'd rather a smear test. I definitely.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I hate it. But my dentist is really good because he allows me to put on earphones and like really loud music.
Oh, yeah.
And then just taps me on the shoulder and stuff. So would a technique like that work for someone with a smear test? Or I suppose you have to be able to hear the doctor at the same time.
You could. It's hard though because you're working in an area where someone has had something really triggering happen. So I think, honestly, just from personal experience with working with a lot of patients who had, I think the best thing is open, constant communication about what you're doing. I think if you sort of zone out, it very much mimics sometimes the mindset that people put themselves in when something triggering like that is happening to them, you know?
That's a really good point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I love that, you know, like people like yourself are aware of that and you're not just plowing straight in and you know, you're trying to be sensitive about people's experiences and that's really... It's reassuring, you know, because it's obviously quite a common issue, sadly.
Very common. Yeah. Very, very common, yeah.
We might finish up on one more positive note. I always don't like to end on a depressing topic because, it's hard. You've said in the book as well, it's safe to skip a period and there's no medical reason why you can't skip a period with contraception and stuff. Mm-hmm. Is that a long-term thing? Can you just keep going forever? Because I know different contraception forms of contraception stop your periods and, you know, like the implant, IUD, all that kind of thing. But with the pill, there's a lot of people. I know when I was in wedding groups, they were like, oh my gosh, I'm going to be on my period for the wedding. And people were saying, just take the pill for an extra few days. So is it safe to do that? How long can you get away with that for? Hopefully forever.
So fascinating story about the pill and why it's designed the way it is. So when you look at a traditional pill pack, it's like three pills of the medicine and 3 weeks and then 1 week of placebo or sugar pills. The whole reason it was designed that way, like back in the 50s and 60s, is because they were afraid of a consumer uptake. They were afraid that if they didn't mimic the natural period, women wouldn't take it. So that is literally the only reason why there's that withdrawal bleed. If you skip that and you just, you know, take the next month or the next month, you could, you know, essentially keep doing that forever, really. It's just that, you know, after a couple of months, you may start to have some breakthrough bleeding. But there is a difference, of course, between if you are not having a period because of something we, quote unquote, the medical community are doing to you, like through a medicine, like, you know, continuous pill or the IUD, versus if you're not on any hormones and you're not having a period, that's a medical issue that needs to be worked out. But yeah, it's totally safe to do.
Okay, I think that will save a lot of people. Because it seems like just periods just don't stop. Because it's like you have the week beforehand where you're just miserable and moody and bloated. And then you have a week of a period. And then, like, you know, you're relieved when it's finally over. And then it starts again, like, 2 weeks later. It's like, it's just never ending. It's true.
We were meant to have, like, 80 babies.
Oh, my God. Well, I think Ireland tried that for a while. Like, yeah. There's a few people way back in my family, and they have, like, 16 kids. And it's like, okay.
Oh, Jesus, yeah.
Your poor womb.
Your poor womb is hanging out by your knees.
Oh my gosh, the joys of it. Yeah, so thankfully we're not in that population density, I suppose, anymore, so that's fantastic. Jen, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for talking, and I just love that you're just busting this myths and stigma around these topics, because they're really common. And like you said, you know, I'm in Ireland, you're in the US, so it's the same myths, the same bits of stigma.
Yeah,
like, you know, and it's in different countries as well. So I'm really grateful that, you know, you wrote the book, that you're doing the work that you're doing, and smashing stigma all over the place. That's the kind of people we like on this podcast. So thank you so, so much. And it's really exciting that Dr. Jen's book, The Vagina Book, will be published tomorrow. So that's the 18th of August. And that book is being published in conjunction with Think's Period Pants. And it's all about periods, vaginas, all those wonderful things that we've talked about on the podcast today. And I'm lucky enough that Thinks are also giving me the opportunity to give away two pairs of period pants. So if you want to hop over and win yourself those, that's awesome. If you hop over to the Instagram, it's Glow West Podcast, and you can figure out how to enter the competition then. So they're amazing. I found them personally to be super comfortable and really easy to just kind of pull on and go, which is what you want. You want a hassle-free period, so that's awesome. Jen's Instagram is Dr. Jen Conti, so that's DrJennconti. On Twitter, she is Dr. Jen, which is the full word doctor, not just the Dior. And thanks to everyone for listening in. I really appreciate your support. If you really like the podcast, please rate and review over on iTunes. If you're on Spotify, you can give us a follow then. And if you really like us and want to help contribute to the electricity bills, you can pop over to Patreon, and that's at patreon.com/tortoiseshack. If you want to follow us on Twitter, it's Glow West Podcast over there as well. And I look forward to chatting to you next week. Bye.